Well, good morning, everybody. It's great to see you today. How many of you got snow over this week? I saw some snow out, a couple cars out in the parking lot. Thanks for coming. And so great to see you here this morning. Turn to your neighbor and say, hey, I'm glad to see you here today. I'm surprised, but I'm glad to see you here today. We've been talking through the book in your Bible named Daniel. Daniel was a guy that lived about 2,500 years ago, and we're in chapter 8 out of his 12 chapters of that book, and he's talking all about the future. So we've been examining a lot about the future, and you know, the future can be a scary thing, can't it? What's going to happen to you tomorrow? What's going to be your life in 5 years, 10 years? What's going to take place in your future? And can you trust God? Every chapter, as we've gone through this book, has been assigned a word, and the word for chapter 8 is trust. Can I trust God with my future? I can't see into it. You know, in chapter 2, Daniel described our futures like a dark room full of mystery. As if you're standing at the doorway of this dark room and you're peering into your future, you're trying to find out who you're going to marry, you're trying to find out what job you're going to have, where you're going to retire, how's your health going to be, where you're going to end it all, you know, where's it going to be your last. If you could just get someone to turn the light on and show you the future, we think we'd have so much more peace. But God doesn't do that, does he? He wants us to trust him. And sometimes he pulls out a flashlight and he'll shine it into the dark mystery of your future and maybe give you a glimpse of a couple of things, but he rarely turns it all on and shows you everything. If he did turn that light on, we would know, according to Daniel, that what you would find in your room is that God's there and he's got a tool belt on and he's cutting and he's sawing and he's hammering and he's building your future. And he's a God full of love and grace for you. So he's building a great future for your life. We asked the question last time, how can we trust Daniel? If Daniel is talking about the future of the human race, how can we trust him? And why should we trust him? And we saw last time, I use these cones as an example. Daniel gives to us some prophecies, we call them, some future foretellings that come true in his own lifetime. That Daniel isn't just somebody that talks about things that are going to happen 100 years or 500 years. He's talking about stuff that happens 12 months. We saw in chapter 4 where Daniel said, you know what, King Nebuchadnezzar, there's going to be a period of time when you go crazy for 7 years and you live out in the pastures. And the Bible tells us that 12 months later, Nebuchadnezzar went crazy for 7 years. And he lived out in the pasture, exactly as Daniel told. God had told Daniel that there's coming a kingdom that's going to conquer the Babylonian Empire. Daniel lived during the Babylonian Empire, and God told him there's a new kingdom coming. And sure enough, just a couple of decades later, here come the Medo-Persian Empire, and they wipe out the Babylonians, and Daniel is transferred from the Babylonian Empire to the Medo-Persian Empire. The reason that we can trust Daniel is because he said some things that happened in his own lifetime to verify that he truly was speaking mysteries from God. So that when Daniel then goes fast forward a couple hundred years and he tells us about another event, we can trust him about this event because he was accurate with those events. Does that make sense? And then when Daniel tells us something that still hasn't happened even in our lifetime, that's still coming way in the future, we can trust him about those things because as we look back through history, we find out, aha, Daniel was right here. And aha, Daniel was right there. So we can trust the book of Daniel because we've lived through history enough to know that those predictions happened, those foretellings, and we know that these prophecies have already taken place because we live about here in history. And so whatever he's going to tell us about those things must be true too, because he was accurate there and he was accurate there. We can trust God with Daniel's images of the future. And you know what? The same is true in your life and in my life. When I face a difficulty and God tells me, Phil, you're going to get through this, I'll carry you through, and all of a sudden, I work my way through that difficulty, and I go, wow, he brought me through. I hope I don't have another one like that. And then all of a sudden, there's another one. And I go, God, are you going to help me through this one? And God says, well, hey, didn't I help you through that one? And so all of a sudden, Phil, you don't know what's going to happen, but I know what's going to happen because I'm working in your future. And all of a sudden, I get through this one, and I go, wow, God, thanks for that and for that. And then, oh, wow. This is a double one. This is like, whoo, this is a big one. Can I trust him for that? See, can we trust God with our futures? Well, how do you measure that? How do I know whether I am or I'm not? I asked myself a couple of questions to measure my trust of God for my future. Number one, is Jesus included in my everyday living? I trust people that are in my everyday living. And if I really trust God, I bring him into everyday life. I bring him into my family life. I bring him into my personal life. I talk with him throughout the day. I might say grace before my meals to acknowledge that everything that I have comes from him. I include him in my everyday living. How included is God in your everyday life? That's a measure of trust. It's a measure of trust. The second question I ask is, do I cling to him in the desperate times? When God allows the unthinkable to happen in your life. I was late for this service because the elders were praying for a family in the prayer room after last service who are in desperate times. They're clinging to Jesus. Do you trust him enough that when you're going through the desperate times, you cling to him. You cling to him. There's a new Christian movie coming out on the 16th of this month. On Monday night, I was invited by a friend to come to the world premiere of that movie. It's called If I Can Only Imagine. You know that famous song, I Can Only Imagine? Well, they've made a movie about the backstory to that song, and it's coming out, and it premiered on Monday night. And so I was invited to this big shindig, right? And it's the red carpet rollout of this movie. And so me and my friend Brody, who invited me to come to this event, we're walking down the red carpet together, and the photographer's there, and we're like, yeah, how you doing, you know? Those things are so stuffy to me, you know? It's just like, then they showed the movie, and after the movie, they brought out all the actors, and they were interviewing the actors, and you heard the name Priscilla Schreier. She does some of our women's Bible study stuff. She was there. She has a little part in the movie. So in the after party, I was going to go up and give her a few pointers about how she can improve her teaching. You know, so I saw her standing over there. And as I'm getting closer to her, I realized, man, she's tall. And I don't know why. I just started walking like this. You know, I'm like. And as I got close, I got, no, I can't do it. I'm intimidated by women that are taller than me. You know, I can't talk to her. But there was another gal in the movie who plays Bart's wife, and her name is Madeline Carroll. And when they asked her on the stage, why did this project attract you? She said, well, let me tell you my story. She said, since I was 3.5 years old, I've been into acting, and I really believed from the time I was young that this was God's path for my life. I want to follow him, and I want to be an actor who follows and loves Jesus, an actress. She said, but as I got into my late teens and early 20s, the roles that started coming my way contained nudity and immorality. And I'd made a commitment to the Lord that I wouldn't act in those roles. I wouldn't go there. So I turned down this role, and I turned down that role, and I turned down this role. And she said, last year, my manager came to me and offered me a big role in a big movie, but it contained some of these immoral elements. And I just told her that, she told her manager, I just can't do that movie. And her manager said, you should reconsider, because this is a big role. This will put you out there. And so she thought and she prayed and she just knew that the Lord wouldn't be honored by that. And so she declined the role. And she said, after I got off the phone with my manager, I went into my bathroom in my house and I got down on the floor and I just bawled like a baby. And I said, God, what are you doing? I thought this was your path for my life. And she said, but you know, as I was down there on the floor crying in the bathroom, I said, God, whatever you want me to do with my life, I will do. Whatever path you have in front of me, Even if it's no longer acting, I will surrender to your plan. And the next day, this project called her and asked her to play this role. But when we're desperate, who do we cling to? Who do we cling to? That's a measure of our trust in God for our future. Another question is, who do I celebrate in, or do I praise him in celebrated times? When things are going really great. When I got that promotion, when I got that answer to prayer, when God healed me, whatever it was, do I include God in the celebration during those wonderful times? Because I trusted him and he brought me through. Daniel shows us a couple of times in this book that when God does something pretty miraculous in his life, he gives him the credit. In fact, he talks to God about how good he is before he talks to other people about the good things that God has done for him. And then finally, do other people notice him in my life? If other people don't notice that Jesus is in my life, it might be an indicator of how much I really am trusting in him. If I don't hardly ever talk about him, if I don't ever hardly give him the credit, if I don't hardly ever tell people I'm clinging to him as I go through these desperate times, if they don't see him in my everyday life, am I really trusting that much in him for my future? Well, in Daniel chapter 8, we started looking at this a couple of weeks ago, and we see that Daniel in chapter 8 is having a vision. It's his second vision. And a vision is just a dream that is more than just a dream. A vision is a dream that God gives to you about something that's going to happen in the future. And so Daniel in chapter 8 is given a vision. And we looked at this a couple of weeks ago, and we saw that the vision was about a couple of animals. And those animals represented something. Now, in order for us to understand what these animals represent, we need to put it in the context of the whole book of Daniel. Because we've seen three times now that God has revealed through Daniel the future. We saw it in chapter 2 when Daniel saw the vision or understood Nebuchadnezzar's dream about the statue. And that the statue represented the coming world kingdoms. And the statue represented the head of gold was the Babylonian kingdom, and then followed by the Medo-Persian kingdom, and then the Greek empire, and then the Roman empire, and then at the bottom or the base of the statue was 10 toes or 10 kings. And then in chapter 7, Daniel has the first of his visions personally, and he sees again four beasts that represent the four world empires. He sees the lion that represents the Babylonian Empire, the bear, the leopard that ran through the world without touching the ground. We know that's Alexander the Great, conquered the Greek Empire. And then this great beast that is the Roman Empire. And the last of the four great beasts has 10 horns. And we know that those 10 horns, we're told, are representations of 10 kings that are coming out of the Roman Empire. And then Daniel's vision gives us a little bit more detail that tells us that after the 10 horns, there's this little horn that comes out of the 10 horns. And then after the little horn is the arrival of God's forever kingdom. So we know from Daniel that human history is laid out. There's going to be four world kingdoms, and then there's going to be the arrival of God's forever kingdom. Now, in chapter 8, Daniel has this second vision, and this vision contains a couple of animals. And we saw last time that the vision in chapter 8, first of all, spoke of a ram that has two horns, and one horn is longer than the other horn, and the younger of the two horns is the longer one, which is unusual because usually the older horn is the longer one. And we understand, according to verse 20 of chapter 8, that the ram represents the Medo-Persian Empire. The two horns are the two parts of the Medo-Persian Empire. The Persian portion came up last, but it became stronger, so that horn is bigger. It's a depiction, according to chapter 8 verse 20, of the Medo-Persian Empire. But then we saw that the ram is trampled down by a goat. And this goat sweeps over the earth without touching the ground, and it tramples to death the ram. And it has a singular horn, which means one powerful king And we're told in chapter 8, verse 21, that this is the Greek Empire, and the horn represents the first king of the Greek Empire, which was who? Alexander the what? Alexander the Great. So we know that the ram represents the Medo-Persian Empire, followed by the Greek Empire. Alexander the Great is the horn. But then we're told, we saw this a couple weeks ago, that the horn is broken at the height of its power. And that out of the place of the one horn in this goat is four horns that follow the one horn. And we know that Alexander the Great, when he died, his kingdom was given to his what? His four generals. And so Alexander the Great's four generals are represented by these four horns. And then we're told, finally, we saw this last time, that out of the four horns comes one little horn. The same thing that happens out of the beast in chapter 7, out of the 10 horns on the beast, one horn rises up. And so out of the four horns of chapter 8, one little horn rises up. And when Daniel sees this vision, he has no idea what it means. You know, sometimes we think, well, why does God use like statues and animals to tell the future? I mean, the way that you and I think is we want the data. We want to know the who and the when and the where, because we're scientifically programmed. But in the ancient world, the way that you communicated truth oftentimes was through stories, through imagery. So 2,500 years ago, it wouldn't be unusual for God to lay out a story and use his animals and imagery instead of scientific data. So we know that in chapter 8, there's the ram, Medo-Persian Empire. There's the goat, the Greek Empire, Alexander the Great. We know that the four horns represent the four generals that comes out of his empire. And then out of those four horns comes this little horn. We looked at this last time. And so let's go to chapter 8, and we're going to pick up the story in verse 15. In verse 15, and we're going to see that Daniel asked the question, when in the world is this going to take place? Where does this dream fit into history? Verse 15, when I, Daniel, had seen the vision, I sought to understand it. And behold, standing before me was one who looked like a man. If you like to underline words in your Bible, underline the word like. It wasn't a man. Maybe it was an angel, but it looked like a man. Verse 16, and I heard the voice of a man between the banks of the Ulai, which is the canal that he was standing by. And he called out and said, Gabriel, which is God's messenger angel, the same angel that went to Mary in the Christmas story. Gabriel, give this man an understanding of the vision. So Gabriel came near to where I was standing. And when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face. But he said to me, son of man, understand that the vision pertains to the time of the what? To the time of the end. It pertains to the end of human history. To that time which is yet in our future. And then in verse 18, and while he was speaking with me, I sank into a deep sleep with my face to the ground. Sounds like a church service right there. He was speaking to me, but he touched me and made me stand upright. Verse 19, and he said, behold, I am going to let you know what will occur at the final period of indignation, for it pertains to the appointed time of the end. So in other words, Daniel is standing back here in time, and God is giving him a vision about what's going to take place at the end of time. And that there's going to be the involvement of the Medo-Persian Empire and the Greek Empire and the four generals and a horn that comes out of the four generals. So our question is, because very clearly he tells us at the end of time, our question is he talking about literally the events at the end of human history? Or is he talking about something that happens that is very similar to that and is a picture of that? Because if he's talking about something that is a picture of that, then we have to find out when it's happened. And if it has happened, then that's another validation That Daniel has been communicated with by God because he gives us a picture of what is yet to take place. So our dilemma in this particular vision this morning is this story of the ram and the goat and the horns and the little horn, is it a description of the actual end times or is it a picture of the end times? Daniel wants to know about this little horn because he seems to be the significant player in this particular vision again. So let's look and see. This little horn, let's look at the description we get of him starting in verse 9 of chapter 8. He's described for us twice. It says, out of one of them, these four horns or these four generals, out of one of the generals came forth a rather small horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the what? The beautiful land, which we know as Israel. So we know that this king is going to attack Israel. Verse 10, it grew up to the host of heaven and caused some of the host and some of the stars to fall to earth, and it trampled them down. This particular king isn't just going to attack people. He's going to try and attack the heavens and the host of heavens. Verse 11, it even magnified itself to be equal with the commander of the host. You'll notice the word commanders, capital C. It's another title given to God. This guy is going to go after God and try to replace God. It says, and it removed the regular sacrifice from him, and the place of his sanctuary was thrown down. This guy is going to come after the temple of God in Jerusalem in Israel. Verse 12, and on account of the transgression, the host will be given over to the horn along with the regular sacrifice, and it will fling truth to the ground and perform its will and prosper. This guy is going to be successful at taking the truth of God, the person of God, and trying to trample him to the ground and attack the people of Israel and the city of Israel, the city of Jerusalem, and the temple inside the city. Verse 13, then I heard a holy one speaking. We're not sure who the holy one is, maybe an angel. And another holy one said to that particular one who was speaking, how long will the vision about the regular sacrifice apply? Will the transgression causes horror, while the transgression causes horror, so that's to allow both the holy place and the host to be trampled? How long is this guy, this horn, going to have destructive power? And the answer in verse 14, he said to me, for 2,300 evenings and mornings. Then the holy place will be properly restored. So this individual, this horn, who is a king, is going to become powerful, and he's going to attack the people of God. He's going to attack the name of God. He's going to attack the temple of God. And for 2,300 days, he's going to wreak havoc, and then everything is going to be restored. So the question is, who is this little horn? Here are some descriptions that we learn. He is a king, a descendant of Alexander's generals. So he has to come out of the dynasty of one of Alexander's generals. We also understand that he's a warm-hearted king, but he's a tyrant. He's skilled with deception. He uses intrigue. If we go to verse 23... it gives another description of this guy, and it says in verse 23, in the latter period of their rule, talking about the four horns, when the transgressors have run their course, a king will arise, insolent and skilled in intrigue. His power will be mighty, but not by his own power. In other words, someone's going to possess him and give him power, and he will destroy to an extraordinary degree and prosper and perform his will. He will destroy mighty men and the holy people. And through his shrewdness, he will cause deceit to succeed by his influence. He's going to be politically manipulative to gain control. And through his shrewdness, he will cause deceit to succeed by his influence and will magnify himself in his heart, and he will destroy many while they are at ease. He will even oppose the prince of princes. Notice the prince is capital P, another title for God. He's going to oppose God, but he will be broken without human agency. The visions of the evening and the mornings, which has been told is true, so it is going to be for 2,300 days, but keep the vision secret, for it pertains to many days in the future. Daniel, this vision that you're getting isn't an immediate one. It's going to pertain to many days in the future. But this guy is going to be a tyrant. We also know that this guy is going to attack God's people and God's program, God's sacrificial system, God's temple. We know that he challenges heaven and the commander. He's so arrogant, he thinks he's equal to God, and he challenges God's position in the universe. And then finally, he wreaks havoc for 2,300 days. Now, depending on which calendar you use, whether it's the Babylonian calendar when these words were written, or whether it was the Jewish calendar, or whether it was the Roman calendar when this, or the Greek calendar when all this comes true, we know that 2,300 days is about 6.5 to 7 years. Okay? So this guy is going to wreak havoc for 6.5 to 7 years, and he's going to come and oppress Israel. So the question is, who is this individual? Is it somebody that is the ultimate antichrist way down here at the end of time? Or is it somebody that takes place earlier that is a picture of that guy to come? So what we have to do is we have to look through history. We have to study history, and we have to study the Medo-Persian Empire and then the rise of Alexander the Great. And then we look at his four generals, and we see, out of any of those four generals, does another king arise to do the things that are identified here in Daniel? So as we look through history, we find a guy. His name is Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. Epiphanes is a title he took for himself, and Epiphany means God revealed. In other words, I'm God. Here I am. Antiochus the Fourth took on the additional title to himself, Epiphanes. Men, when you get home from work tomorrow and you walk in the house, just say, "Honey, Epiphanes is here." And see how your evening goes. See how it goes. How arrogant, right? To take on the title Epiphanes. Well, Antiochus Epiphanes is a real character in history. He's a real king. Is that who Daniel is talking about? Or is Daniel talking about the future Antichrist down there? Well, let's see. What did Antiochus Epiphanes do? Did he do the things described for us in Daniel chapter 8? So let's look through history just for a minute. In 323 BC, Alexander the Great dies, and he leaves his empire to four generals. And we see on the map in front of you that Cassander takes the region of Macedonia and Greece. We see that Lysimachus takes on the territories of Asia Minor and a territory called Thrace. We see that Seleucus takes on Syria and Mesopotamia. And we see that Ptolemy takes on the area of Egypt and some of lower Israel. This box right here is the land of Israel. The white little dot is the city of Jerusalem. And we see that Ptolemy takes part of this. He also has some territory up here. But this is the territory of the four generals from Alexander the Great. So these four generals take reign and rulership of their territories. And about 125 years later, when these territories have become dynasties, something interesting happens. This man named Antiochus III, not the fourth, but the third, who is part of the Seleucus dynasty, rises up and he invades Egypt. And that starts a war between the dynasty of Seleucus and Ptolemy. And we know that, according to history, 175 BC, this king, who was a king from the Seleucus dynasty, rises up and takes power. And we know that history tells us that Antiochus Epiphanes hated the Jews. And because the Israel was right in between his kingdom and Ptolemy's kingdom, Israel took the brunt of a lot of his wrath. In fact, history tells us that in 170 BC, Antiochus Epiphanes murders Annas III, who was the high priest in Jerusalem, in the temple. He murders him, and that starts a clash between Antiochus Epiphanes and the Jewish people. We also see that in 169 BC, Antiochus Epiphanes, like his father before him, attacks Egypt. And as he comes down into Egypt, he conquers some land, but he runs out of money. And as he's returning back to his homeland, he goes through Israel and he goes into Jerusalem and he has his soldiers go into the temple of Jehovah, Israel's God, and takes 1,800 talents of gold out of the treasury and steals them and takes them back home. Again, developing a clash between the Jewish people and Antiochus Epiphanes. We also know that a year later, in 168 BC, Antiochus Epiphanes wants to attack Egypt again, and so he moves down to attack Egypt, but this time this little fledgling army called the Roman army teams up with Ptolemy's army, and they go and they stop Antiochus Epiphanes from coming into Egypt, and they say to Antiochus Epiphanes, "You have a choice today. If you attack, you are going to be battling against both Ptolemy's armies and Roman armies, or you can turn around and go home." And Antiochus Epiphanes put his tail between his legs and he turned around and he went home. But on his way home, he took out his wrath on Israel. And he went into the city of Jerusalem and he started slaughtering Jews. And he went to the temple, and in 167 BC, he sets up an altar in the temple to Zeus, the Greek god. And he dedicates the temple to God in Jerusalem to Zeus. And as you know, as you can imagine, that sent the Jewish people into a tizzy. Not only had Antiochus Epiphanes killed their high priest, not only had he stolen their money, not only had he slaughtered their people, now he's desecrating the temple and putting Zeus as the god of Jerusalem. So in 164 BC, the Jews revolt. It's called the Maccabean Revolt. The Maccabees were the priests at the time, and they revolt, and they actually throw Zeus out. And they cleanse and rededicate the temple. Now, we don't know exactly the exact date of the year that Onias was murdered. And we don't know the exact date of the year that the Jews revolted. But between 170 BC and 164 BC is about 2,300 days. And remember what it says about what was going to take place at the end of the 2,300 days. It says that that will all be restored. So the cleansing of the temple to kick Zeus out could be what's described for us in Daniel as the holy place will be set back in order. So what's so interesting about all of this is that Daniel, when he got this vision about what was going to happen, was standing at 550 BC. And what he's just described of the Medo-Persian Empire and then the Greek Empire and Alexander the Great dying and the four generals and then Antiochus Epiphanes coming out of the Seleucus dynasty and attacking Israel wasn't going to happen for 125 years. But it fits it to a T. So what then we can understand is that what Daniel is being told in chapter 8 is not the actual end of time, but it's an event that happens that is a picture of the end of time. And as Antiochus Epiphanes was a hater of Israel and attacker of the beautiful land, so this true future Antichrist is going to do something very similar, but to a much more harsh scale. And so Daniel, again, is telling the people of Israel, when you see this happen, you can trust that that's going to happen. So Daniel, again, is standing in 550 BC. He's declaring things that happened within a year or two of his lifetime, a couple of decades maybe. He's declaring something that's happening 125 years later. And when it happened, he's telling the people of Israel, so if you see I was faithful in those and faithful in this, you can trust me for that. You can trust me for that. So what's the message of Daniel 8? The message of Daniel 8 is very simple. Israel, trust me. Trust God. God has laid out the future. You can't see into that dark mystery room, but God is in that room. God is working in your future. God is going to allow you to go through some tough stuff, but then there's going to be a divine rescue. And just as Israel survived Antiochus Epiphanes, so Israel is going to survive the future Antichrist that's going to yet come. And God is telling his people, trust me. Trust me. And you know what? That's the same message for you and I today, isn't it? That, you know what? God has told us how it's all going to ultimately end. Jesus told us in John 14, right? I go to prepare a place for you, right? And if I go to prepare a place for you, I'm going to come and receive you so that you'll be with me for how long? Forever. So God has already told us the end. And God told us that on our way to the end, we're going to have some tough stuff. But then he's going to rescue us. He's going to rescue us. John chapter 16, Jesus said, you know what? I'm telling you some hard stuff is coming, and I'm telling you this, John chapter 16, so that when you see it happen, you won't stumble. In other words, hey, folks, when you're going through the tough stuff, just remember that I told you that it was coming and that I'm going to see you through. And that's God's message for you today. Yeah, you're going to go through some tough stuff. Jesus said, in this world you will have what? Tribulation. But be of good cheer because I have overcome the world and I will never leave you or what? Forsake you. So listen, folks, when you're going through that tough stuff, just remember God has it all laid out. Don't be surprised when tough stuff happens because Jesus said it's coming. And when he's gotten you through stuff in the past, you can trust him with the difficulty that is right in front of you. And then have the hope that one day he has that ultimate mansion waiting for you in heaven. So take courage and take hope to heart because your future is all laid out for him and you can trust him. So the question is very simple. Do you trust God with your future? Are you inviting him into the everyday things of life? Are you clinging to him in the desperate times? Are you including him in the celebrated times? And do other people see him in your life? Those are indicators that you are trusting God for the dark mystery of your future. Let's stand together and pray. Lord, I love how Daniel ends this chapter. He just said he's exhausted, he's sickly, and he doesn't really understand. And Lord, that could describe so many of us at certain times in our life. We don't understand what we're going through and why we're going through it. We're tired. We're exhausted. But Lord, we can have rest, we can have peace, knowing that you are working in our futures on our behalf. Thank you for the hope that Daniel gives to us, that we can trust that history is taking place according to your will. And Lord, the future of our life is in your hands. May we cling to you during the desperate times, may we celebrate you in the great times, and may we be a witness for you at all times. In Jesus' name. Amen. Let's sing together.